We're going to continue with our recent Sunday morning study that we've been involved in about salvation and works. And to review briefly, we have looked at the fact that there are different kinds of works that the Lord speaks about in his word, two broad categories of kinds of works, that is, those that are works of God and those that are not, that he will typically refer to as works of men and identifies the devil as being the source of those works that are not of God. And so when it pertains to our salvation and the role of works in our salvation, very clearly the Lord teaches that it has to be those works of God that are involved in our salvation, which ultimately we want to get into in much detail for this study to see what those works of God are that do pertain to and are required and are part of our eternal salvation. But we have looked a little bit at, just touched on some of those works of man and looking at some scriptures and how the works that man does on his own that are not of God are not going to save mankind. We cannot save ourselves by our own works. And we've been then looking at one category of works of God that are not part of our salvation. We're not designed to bring about man's eternal salvation, and that is specifically the works of the Old Testament law. So that stands in a category by itself, because there are only two God-ordained religions, two covenants given by God for man that has ever existed. The first was that covenant that God gave to the children of Israel, the physical nation of Israel, that is the Old Testament law. That was from God. The other, of course, is the everlasting covenant, the new covenant that he brought through Christ. Well, that New Testament, what Christ brought was very much the works and the means for man's eternal salvation. Obviously, there were things that Christ did, including his sacrifice on the cross, that were necessary for our eternal salvation. But by his covenant, he does have requirements of us, works of God that we must do in order to have eternal salvation. So that's ultimately what we want to bring our study to, those particular works. But those works that God gave through the law of Moses to the children of Israel in the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, that was not designed to justify man or to bring about his or accomplish his eternal salvation. And so we spent a good bit of time looking at some scriptures, particularly in Romans chapters 3 and 4, Galatians chapters 2 and 3, where he very specifically, and we were looking very carefully at the context in all of those passages where without any dispute, if one is to look at all that God is teaching in those particular books or those chapters where that subject comes up, he's referring to the Old Testament law, the works of the law of Moses, and none other in those passages is he talking about. So when he says that we are not saved by the works of the law, whenever he says that in those passages, he is specifically and exclusively talking about the works of the Old Testament law. So those works did not save man, were not designed by God to. So they were works of God. There were commandments that he gave through Moses. I think Brother Johnson named 600 and something of them. It's difficult for me to count those because it's hard to note where he says, thou shalt, and then there are conditional parts to it. Well, if this, then do that, or if not, then do this. So that's a little difficult for me to try to separate those and enumerate those commandments. But that sounds like a reasonable number, so 600 and something, whatever that number is of those commandments that God gave through the law of Moses or in that law, they were not designed to save man or to justify man. Now, those commandments were required of God, and every disobedience received its just recompense of reward from God. They were punished by God for disobeying those commandments, for not fulfilling the works that he gave. And one other part that we read about that, especially in Galatians 3, when he quotes from the book of Deuteronomy, was that particular covenant, the law of Moses, did bring a curse upon all those who did not keep every law of that covenant. So everyone that ever lived under it was cursed by it, with the one exception of Jesus Christ, who did no sin and fulfilled all of that covenant. And it was then nailed to his cross when he died, and it was taken out of the way for mankind as a religious law. So we're no longer under that, but that was God's intention, that would be fulfilled by his son and be brought to an end, and that he would then establish the new and everlasting covenant that would save mankind. But those commandments that God gave by the law of Moses, God did not design to. That was not his intent, to save man by that covenant. And as part of that, then we spent our last study last Sunday morning looking at a category of requirements that God has for man that he did not include as a requirement or a command in the Old Testament law. And we touched on some of those. We did not look at every one, but some of the major ones we did look at, such as faith. There was no commandment by the law of Moses that said, thou shalt believe. But God, of course, always has required faith in man, by man, in him. And so faith, though it's a requirement of God, was not part of the Old Testament law as a commandment. The same was also the case with repentance, that being another requirement of God, that man repent of his sins to obtain God's mercy and forgiveness. That's always been a requirement of God, but that's another one that was not included as one of the works of the Old Testament law itself. Mercy was another one. And so there are many of those. And of course, all those principles were taught by God in the Old Testament. And we can see those principles through the commandments that he gave. But as far as being an explicit commandment in the Old Testament law, there are many of those requirements that God has that he did not include as requirements in that law that God required anyway. So man would have to meet God's requirements outside of the law of Moses itself in order to obtain God's mercy and to obtain his favor and his forgiveness. That's part of how the Old Testament law was not designed to bring about man's eternal salvation. And that was by God omitting some of his requirements from that law itself. Well, the flip side of that is that God also permitted things in that law of Moses that he did not approve of. And so there were some of the old works of the Old Testament law that man could do that would bring about God's disfavor, his disapproval. Not only by not including some necessary things in the Old Testament law would man not be able to obtain his salvation by the works of that law, but also by doing some of the works of that Old Testament law, that could bring them into God's disfavor, his disapproval. And we want to look at some specific examples of that. I'm not going to assert a notion of that sort without us finding that in the Word of God. So we can't go by anything I say. We have to go by what the Lord says. And we'll see some very clear examples of this. The first one that we want to look at is that of divorce. The Old Testament law did permit divorce. Now, when we go back to the very beginning, when God established marriage in the book of Genesis, there's no mention at the end of Genesis chapter 2 when God created the woman, Eve, and gave her to Adam to be his wife. And he said, therefore, shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Well, God established marriage and the family and that that particular covenant there that is still in existence today. But as God designed that there, there's no mention of divorce. That was not something that God intended. That was not something that God established. Somewhere after God established the covenant of marriage, somewhere man developed the tradition, the work of divorce, of bringing a marriage to an end, not by the death of one of the parties to the marriage covenant, either the man or the woman. We know that when a man or when the husband or the wife dies, the marriage is ended by death, and that's why the vow is that we will fulfill the duties of husband and wife till death do us part. And we understand that and recognize that and make that clear by our vows when we are married. But where did this come along that a marriage would end by divorce and not by the death of one of the parties to the marriage covenant? Well, that was obviously something that was begun by man, not by God. And so when the old covenant was established, was that a common practice in the world? Well, evidently it was. And so God then permitted that practice in the Old Testament law. Well, let's look at that to see that that is the case. In Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4. Now, this is part of the Old Covenant. This is part of the Law of Moses right here. So we're reading at least one of the works of the Old Testament law in this passage. And divorce was one of the works, one of the deeds of that law that they were permitted to do. Now, we'll notice here, God didn't command them to divorce, but he did permit that. One could practice this, fulfill these verses, Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, and divorce a man could divorce his wife for any cause and be legal by the law of Moses, but we'll see that that was not something that God approved of. And though he might be legal by the law of Moses, he would be out of favor with God because he would be practicing something that God did not approve of and that God, in fact, said that he hated. He hated it, even though he allowed it in the law. And we'll read that what Christ said is the reason why God allowed something that he hated, because that would be a question that any of us would reasonably ask. Well, if God hated this practice, and if he disapproved of divorce, why did he allow it in his law? Well, let's look at this law of Moses and what he said in Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. When a man had taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes, because he hath found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and send her out of his house. And when she is departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. And if the latter husband hate her and write her a bill of divorcement and giveth it in her hand and sendeth her out of his house, or if the latter husband die which took her to be his wife, her former husband which sent her away may not take her again to be his wife. After that she is defiled. For that is abomination before the Lord, and thou shalt not cause the land to sin, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. And in fact, it's in that fourth verse that we can really tell what God thought of this practice that he was permitting here in these verses. So he was allowing a man to divorce his wife for any cause, and then she could become another man's wife. And obviously, then he could marry another himself. But what did God think of the man that put away his wife, that divorced her? Well, we can see that in verse 4, because if her next husband divorced her, or if he died and she was no longer in a marriage, God did not permit that man who divorced her to marry her again, and said because she was defiled. Well, defiled in what way? Because she could be another man's wife. So was the defilement on her part? Very apparently not, because he was the one not allowed to marry her again. And that would cause the land to sin. So it's quite clear from that that God did not approve of the man doing that. Well, that's even more clear, if that's not clear enough for anybody to learn what God thought of it from that verse. It's very clear in Malachi, the last book of the Old Testament, the book of Malachi in chapter 2, verses 13 through 16. Malachi 2, 13 through 16. He says, "And this have you done again, covering the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping, and with crying out, insomuch that he regardeth not the offering anymore, or receiveth it with goodwill at your hand." All right, so here God is plainly saying that he was not regarding the offerings of some of these men, and God was not receiving it with goodwill from their hands. Well, who were these ones that he was not receiving their offerings, and why? Well, the first thing he says is because the Lord's altar was covered with tears and weeping and crying. Well, who was weeping and crying? These women that they divorced. And that's what he says in the next verse, verse 14. He says, "Yet you say, wherefore?" You're saying, why? Why aren't you receiving my offerings, Lord? He says, "Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. Yet is she thy companion, and the wife of thy covenant." And there God uses that word covenant. That's what marriage is. It is a covenant. And so when they divorced their wives that they had entered into the covenant of marriage with, they were breaking a covenant. And God does not approve of the breaking of a covenant. And so they were breaking their vows that they had made when they entered into that covenant with their wives. So they were divorcing her. So the law permitted it. The law of Moses permitted that. They were practicing that. But God was not receiving their offerings when they were doing that, because they had broken their covenant. He says, "And did not he make one? Yet had he the residue of the Spirit, and wherefore one, that he might seek a godly seed? Therefore, take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. For the Lord, the God of Israel, saith that he hateth putting away." That word putting away is the word for divorce. He says God hates divorce. So God permitted it in Deuteronomy 24 under the law of Moses. He was permitting, he was allowing them to engage in a practice that he hated. When they were doing that, when they were performing that particular work of the law of Moses and engaging in a practice that God allowed but hated, God was not receiving their offerings anymore because they were breaking their covenant and engaging in something that he hated. And so the Lord, the God of Israel, saith that he hateth putting away, for one covereth violence with his garment, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore, take heed to your spirit that you deal not treacherously. They were dealing treacherously against their wives by divorcing them. and God was not receiving their offering. Well, if God wasn't receiving what they were offering to him then, and they come before him on the day of judgment in that state, are they going to have their soul saved? And the answer is very obviously no. So this would cost them their souls engaging in this practice that God hated. In Matthew chapter 19, the Pharisees questioned Jesus on this particular issue. And we can see from what Jesus taught that what God established in the beginning in the book of Genesis, when he established marriage, that God was, through Christ, was restoring that. And by the New Testament and by the teachings of it, which is what all men are going to answer to God for, we cannot practice that divorce under the law of Christ and be legal with the Lord. Well, even the ones that did it under the Old Testament, though they were legal by the law of Moses, they were outside of God's favor, and he wouldn't receive their offerings because they were doing something that was wicked that God hated. But let's read from Matthew chapter 19, verses 3 through 9. The Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him and saying unto him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? Now, the question was it lawful? Is it legal? Well, what would be the very short answer concerning the law of Moses? Was it legal by that law? Well, the answer, the technical answer to whether it was lawful, was it legal or not, was, well, yes, it was legal. But he was not going to give them that short answer and allow them to continue to deceive themselves into thinking that meant legal was okay with God. Legal, yes. Morally right, no. So what was Jesus' answer? He answered and said unto them, have you not read that which he made, that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? So he's going back to Genesis chapter 2 and quoting from that. Well, were they reading that? They may have liked to read Deuteronomy 24 to justify themselves. Are they bringing up Malachi 2 that we just read from? Are they bringing up Genesis 2 that we read from, that Jesus is quoting here? They weren't bringing those statements of God up. They were not bringing up those scriptures. But Jesus reminded them of what God said at the beginning when he made them male and female and said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Have you not read that? Jesus asked them. And that's what God established in the beginning. And that's what Jesus was reestablishing here. Nothing new, but going back to what God originally established, and the fact that he did not allow divorce in the beginning, and he's not allowing it now. Jesus said, wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. Marriage, when the husband and the wife are qualified to be married, where is that covenant made, and who is that from? And that's from God, and that covenant is established in heaven. Now again, the parties that are coming together have to meet God's requirements to be eligible to be married. One of those that up until very recent times was not one that had to be, had to have a lot of attention paid to it, but it's what he says it here. He made them at the beginning male and female. Well, that's quoting from Genesis chapter 2. So what is one of the basic requirements that God has made? Well, he's going to join together male and female in marriage. Well, what does that then exclude? What did God not include there in the beginning? He did not include male and male or female and female. So God made them at the beginning male and female, and there are not a bunch of other genders either. Even though man has come up with that, that's not from God. So whatever a man comes up with, and with all these other different so-called genders, no, in the beginning, God made two. There's still two. And marriage is only going to be from God with a male and female to be married. And also, we can very easily see from that that this only includes one male and one female. Polygamy was not established by God in the beginning. I was reading very recently, in fact, it was somewhere in this past week, that this was going to become a battle. There's some of these that have pushed the boundaries in society of many of these issues that are very much against the will of God. A lot of these things that have happened in recent years, a continual attack on morality and on the things that God has established and taught in his word. It really is a relentless attack. It's from the devil, but he's got a lot of men that in his service trying to continue to make various forms of sin to be acceptable in society. Well, the next big battle is there's some that are pushing for the legalization of plural marriages and all kinds of form. Well, once you've thrown out the gender requirement, why is the number requirement going to be of any, why would that be sacred? And so we can be prepared for that to happen. And so it would not be surprising at all if in our future, our near future, we see some of that taking place when they're going to legalize plural marriages of various sorts. And it takes away all meaning of what God taught in his word about marriage. And God is not going to be a party to that either. But he made them male and female at the beginning. And so that's a requirement, that it's one male and one female is a requirement. So the gender and the requirement and the number are part of God's requirements. No divorce, no same gender marriages, no plural marriages. None of that was from the beginning. And if any of that happens, if man makes that legal, it's not, God is not a party to it. God's not going to be joining those together. Whom does God join together? Well, those that are that he deems to be eligible to be brought together in marriage. And so we've covered some of that. Another one that comes out at the end of this passage in Matthew 19, 3-9, one that has been divorced does not have God's approval to marry again. So that would be someone else that God is not going to join with another. So if somebody who's been divorced marries another, well, that marriage, God is not going to join that together. So the principle that Jesus brings up there in this passage is that what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. So yes, man may write a certificate in a court, and you may go to a courthouse and where man is recognizing the joining together of all sorts that God is not joining together, but God is not forced into that by man's works. So this reminds us again, there are works of man and works of God, and these other kinds of marriages that God doesn't approve of, those are works of men, not of God. But what God has joined together, Jesus said, let not man put asunder. So is divorce a work of God or a work of man? That's a work of man. Jesus says that plainly, let not man put asunder. God's not going to be putting it asunder. Man is. And that's the reason why God said the one who is divorced and marries another, and the one who marries the one that is divorced, is committing adultery. Well, it's adultery because in God's sight, he brought them together and joined them together to another. To begin with, man has put them asunder, but God hasn't. So they're still in his sight married. And therefore, if someone who is married marries someone else, they're guilty of adultery. That's why he uses that word in this passage. They say unto him, why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? Well, did God command everybody to divorce? Well, we read from Deuteronomy 24, he allowed that, and Jesus is going to use that word, but they're saying, why did Moses then command her? As if they're obeying a command that they had to divorce their wives. Well, no, he's not commanded that. And so Jesus said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, suffered you, that is, allowed you to put away, that is, divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. So there's the reason. It says Moses, and of course we know, as we've seen with a number of scriptures, as we started into this subtopic of the works of the Old Testament law, that the works of the Old Testament law, what he calls the law of Moses, is the law of the Lord. Everything that Moses spoke and wrote, of course, came from God. So to say Moses allowed, that's exactly the same as saying God allowed. God allowed it through Moses. But he said, and they asked, why did Moses do this? And so Jesus says, Moses, why did Moses command? Jesus says, Moses allowed because of the hardness of your hearts. But from the beginning, it was not so. So that was the reason God allowed that work, allowed something he hated to be done. It was because their hearts were hard. So he allowed them to divorce their wives. Does God ever give to man something that man desires, even though it's not good? Well, there's lots of examples of that. When they were whining and complaining in the wilderness about their food and they wanted meat to eat, did he give them quails to eat? He gave them their desire, but he judged them for it. And while it was in their teeth, he brought his judgment down upon them. So God did not approve of that murmuring and the complaining that they were making against him. But they said they wanted it, and God gave it to them. But the fact that God permitted them to have that meat, it certainly did not mean that he approved of them having it, and he judged them for that wicked desire that they had, even though he let them have what they did desire. When they demanded to have a king, was that God's design that Israel have a king? No, they wanted to be like the nations around them. God let them have a king, but he warned them, here's what's going to happen to you by having a king. And it did. All those things that God said were fulfilled. And eventually he brought back what he established in the beginning with their judges. Though we'll read the word governors after the return from the exile in Babylon. But God chose their leaders like he had done from the beginning with the judges. But there are a number of examples like that where God did give, because of the hardness of the hearts of his people, give them desires that they had that were not good desires. And he judged them for their wicked desires. But Jesus very clearly said, from the beginning it was not so. God did not establish divorce. And I say unto you, this is verse 9 of Matthew 19, and I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery, and whoso marrieth her which is put away doth commit adultery. God still doesn't command it here, but he does permit one case for divorce under the law of Christ, and that is one who is innocent. If their spouse is guilty of committing fornication, the innocent party does have the option of divorcing the guilty one and being able to marry again. Of course, that would be to marry somebody who is also eligible to be married in order for God to join them together in that marriage. But the one who has been divorced, for that one to marry another or for someone to marry them, they are committing adultery because they are not permitted to marry another as God had joined them in that marriage. And they did not have the one case in which they were approved of putting away their spouse. So that's what Jesus taught, and that's the law we're under. Now, most of our states these days have what they call no-fault divorces, and that's also true in South Carolina. So one can put away their husband or wife. Somebody can go down and divorce, and you don't even have to really have a reason anymore. And I don't know if there are any states that require a reason. So one can be legal in South Carolina or really just about any state in our country and most countries of the world. These days, you can be legal by the law of the land and by divorcing, and you can also be legal by the law of the land to marry all kinds of enter all kinds of marriages that God is not going to be the one joining them together. But that doesn't mean God is forced to approve of it. He doesn't. So without God's approval, even though man says it's okay, one can be legally right, but be morally very wrong. And that was the case with divorce. Another example of this from the Old Testament law, this is another kind of work that God allowed under the law of Moses, but something that God did not approve of. Well, another one of those was vengeance. Leviticus chapter 24, 19 and 20. Leviticus 24, 19 and 20 says, "And if a man cause a blemish in his neighbor as he hath done, so shall it be done to him. Breach for breach, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. As he hath caused a blemish in a man, so shall it be done to him again." So did God allow vengeance under the law of Moses? To take an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, life for life. That was allowed by the law of Moses. So this was a work of the law of Moses that a person could engage in and be legal with that law. But is this something that God approved of? Did God approve of vengeance? Was that something that God approved of man to take? Well, no. In fact, we can read many examples of that that we'll get to. Another case, another Old Testament passage where we can see a type of vengeance that God allowed that very much runs contrary to all that God would desire of God's own qualities, of God's nature to be in man, the parts of his love, compassion, forgiveness, forbearance, meekness, and kindness. These are things that you could not have to do what we'll read about here in Numbers chapter 35, starting in verse 9. And this pertained to the cities of refuge that they had in under the Old Testament law. But Numbers 35, let's start in verse 9. It says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When you become over Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall appoint you cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the slayer may flee thither, which killeth any person at unawares." So he's not talking about murder. He's talking about when somebody has inadvertently, it's what we call by our law today, involuntary manslaughter, when somebody accidentally kills someone. He says, "And they shall be unto you cities for refuge from the avenger, that the manslayer die not, until he stand before the congregation in judgment. And of these cities which ye shall give, six cities shall you have for refuge. Ye shall give thee three cities on this side Jordan, and three cities shall ye give in the land of Canaan, which shall be cities of refuge. These six cities shall be a refuge, both for the children of Israel, and for the stranger, and for the sojourner among them, that everyone that killeth any person unawares may flee thither. And if he smite him with an instrument of iron so that he die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. And if he smite him with throwing a stone wherewith he may die, and he die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. Or if he smite him with a hand weapon of wood wherewith he may die, and he die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. The revenger of blood himself shall slay the murderer. When he meeteth him, he shall slay him. But if he thrust him of hatred, or hurl at him by laying of weight, that he die, or in enmity smite him with the hand, that he die, he that smote him shall surely be put to death, for he is a murderer. The revenger of blood shall slay the murderer when he meeteth him. But if he thrust him suddenly without enmity, or have cast upon him anything without laying of weight, or with any stone wherewith he may die, wherewith a man may die, seeing him not, and cast it upon him that he die, and was not his enemy, neither sought his harm, then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the revenger, of blood according to these judgments. And the congregation shall deliver the slayer out of the hand of the revenger of blood, and the congregation shall restore him to the city of his refuge, whither he was fled, and he shall abide in it unto the death of the high priest, which was anointed with the holy oil. But if the slayer shall at any time come without the border of the city of his refuge, whither he was fled, and the revenger of blood find him without the borders of the city of his refuge, and the revenger of blood kill the slayer, he shall not be guilty of blood, because he should have remained in the city of his refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the slayer shall return into the land of his possession. So if a person committed what we call involuntary manslaughter, what he's talking about here, when there was an accidental killing, and he flees to this city of refuge, he has to stay there. He can't go home. He has to stay in one of those cities of refuge until the death of the high priest. Well, what if it's a middle-aged man and the high priest is recently taken his position? He's younger. The high priest may outlive him. In which case, he's stuck in that city of refuge for the rest of his life. However long, if the high priest died within his lifetime, only then could he safely leave the city of refuge and go back home where the family member of the one who had died would be able to take his life. But if he left that city of refuge before the death of the high priest, then that avenger of blood could come kill the person and not be guilty. Now, that was allowed by the law of Moses. Question, would God approve of that? So somebody accidentally, with no intent, accidentally kills your relative, and they're judged to have been innocent of murder. But they're in that city of refuge, and you just wait and wait and wait, just looking to see if they come out of that city for any reason before the high priest dies, and they come out, and then you kill them. Well, you'd be legally right. Is that the heart of a person? Is that kind of heart of God that God desires a person to have? That's vengeance. It was legal, but that's not what God would want or desire any of us to be like. Romans 12, 19 through 22. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. In fact, this is one of the issues that makes the new covenant so different from the old one. And makes those who are under the law of Christ, by having the heart of Christ, the heart of God himself, this will allow us to have that heart and will make us different, not just from those who may have practiced vengeance under the Old Testament law, but those of the world today. We can see what Jesus taught in Matthew 5, 38 to 48. You've heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Well, that's what the law of Moses said. So it allowed vengeance. Well, did Jesus include that in his covenant? No, he says, but I say unto you that you resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. You've heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love them which love you, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans the same? And if you salute your brethren only, what do you more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect, complete in his love, including a love for one's enemies. That's the heart that God has, and that's the heart that he's desiring us to have, and that heart we have when we follow the new covenant. But was that the heart that was that would be behind the works of the Old Testament law that allowed vengeance. No, it isn't. And that's why Jesus identified those particular statements and said that that was not to remain the case under his covenant. In 1 John 2:5, Jesus said, "But whoso keepeth his word, in him verily is the love of God perfected." Well, that's the new covenant. When we keep the new covenant, we perform the works of the law of Christ, we will be like Christ. We will have God's love perfected in us if we keep that word. That is very different than the works of the Old Testament law. And we'll close with Hebrews 7:11-19. "If therefore perfection were by the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should rise after the order of Melchizedek and not be called after the order of Aaron? For the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law. For he of whom these things are spoken pertaineth to another tribe, of which no man gave attendance at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord sprang out of Judah, of which tribe Moses spake nothing concerning priesthood. And it is yet far more evident, for that after the similitude of Melchizedek, there ariseth another priest, who is made not from the law of a carnal commandment, but after the power of an endless life. For he testifieth, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. For there is verily a disannulling of the commandment going before, for the weakness and unprofitableness thereof. For the law made nothing perfect, but the bringing in of a better hope did, by the which we draw nigh unto God." So he plainly states that the works of the Old Testament law, there was weakness and unprofitableness in that. It permitted things that God did not desire in the heart of man. Those things he did establish and make part of the law of Christ. It is a better covenant based on better promises. That very clearly shows the inferiority of the old covenant. That was by God's design. So it did not include some of the things that God required. It also permitted some of the things, some things that God disapproved of. But by the works of the Old Testament law, man could not be saved. That is part of and the reason for the law of Christ, the new and everlasting covenant. Lord willing, next time we want to look in some more detail about the works of man. So we've looked at the one case now of God's works that God established that were not designed to save man. We've already touched on the fact that the category of works of man is a category that won't save man, but we did not go into a lot of detail about that, and there's a lot that is in God's word that teaches us that point that we do want to look at, Lord willing, next time that we study together. So Lord willing, next Sunday morning, we will look at that, as then from there, we want to go into the works of God by the law of Christ that do save mankind. Appreciate everybody with your attention this morning, and we would hope that we will all be encouraged in following in the covenant that God has blessed us with under Christ, by which if we keep his word, we will truly have the love of God perfected in us. Brother Dave, you can lead us in our closing prayer.